I'm Josh Levin. I'm the co-founder and general manager of West End Cinema.
Now, Josh, I was sad to when I woke up today and saw that the West End Cinema will be closing down later this month.
That's correct.
When's the actual final day?
Our last day of operations is going to be Sunday, the 29th of March.
Okay, so we got a couple more weeks to get out there, guys. Why'd you make this decision? How'd you guys come to this decision?
Well, we've been operating for 5 years, and we have loved doing what we've been doing, but we're facing increased occupancy costs and increased competition for titles, and we just felt like the writing was on the wall. So we decided to leave with our heads held high and declare victory and depart the field.
Right. Before we get into more about the closing, take me a little bit about just the history of it. Was there used to be a West End Cinema before you guys relaunched it in 2010?
So there was a West End Theater, and then there were two theaters on the little strip of the West End that we're in, mm-hmm. called the Inner Circle 1234 and the Inner Circle 567.
Is that technically Foggy Bottom or DuPont?
I always thought of it as Foggy Bottom, but at some point the realtors decided that it was West End.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
We're at 23rd and M Street, so we are right between DuPont Circle on one side, Georgetown on the other, mm-hmm. Foggy Bottom right below us.
Gotcha.
We moved into a space that had been vacant for 7 years, but had been the old Inner Circle 567 theater. So it was already a theater in terms of its design. It already had projectors, although those projectors are now obsolete,
right,
due to the shift to digital projection. It already had slope floors. It already was zoned and licensed as a theater space. So we chose to move in there, and I love the neighborhood that we're in. We get a lot of George Washington University students and Georgetown University students. We get a lot of people who are generally considered empty nesters, people who've moved back into the city after raising their kids in the suburbs, and they want to live in a vibrant part of town.
Right.
And we're surrounded by new hotels and new residential buildings. It's a great, great part of DC to be in. Unfortunately, the numbers just haven't added up.
Right. Did you guys have, was it all, I've been there a few times. Is it all digital screeners?
Well, at this point, everything we've shown for, I would say the last year has been shown on digital. We still have 35 millimeter film projectors, but we can't get content.
Gotcha.
To show on those projectors.
Gotcha. How'd you guys go? I mean, you mentioned earlier that, the writing was on the wall between, trying to get the titles and, and tickets. Explain the process for listeners who wouldn't know how that works. What's the process of, distribution, whereas where you would actually decide which titles you got and how much that would cost and that sort of thing?
Well, as a general rule, it's about 50-50 between films that we pursue and film distributors that pursue us. I've had a great booker, a woman named Connie White, who books several art house cinemas around the U.S., mm-hmm. Who is my primary conduit to the distributors. And so throughout the year at every festival, there's conversation about where films are going to go. And then sometimes several months in advance, we'll get a booking. Sometimes on a Monday, I'll find out something's available for that Friday. Obviously, for planning purposes, the months in advance works a little bit better in terms of letting our audience know what's coming.
Right.
But sometimes the film that you can get on Monday is a film that there's enough interest in that opening it on Friday makes sense.
Right. And I mean, I'm trying to remember some of the movies I've seen there in the last couple of years. I think I saw My Week with Marilyn there. I think I saw most recently, I came and saw The Babadook there. And I remember you guys were playing Force Majeure as well.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of titles that you can, maybe only see. It was West End, maybe Shirlington, maybe E Street Cinema, Angelica Pop-Up. But it's going to be a loss. I'm going to feel the loss, and I'm sure a lot of people around here, in terms of a lot of independent films, foreign films, stuff that kind of was a little below the radar. The big tentpole movies are going to do fine at the multiplex, but in terms of coming to see some of the, under the radar hidden gems, I'm going to miss the West End for that, for sure.
Well, I appreciate that. There is good news.
Let's hear the good news.
For film fans, which is in D.C. in the next 2 years, the Angelica, you mentioned they opened the pop-up up by Union Market. They're building a permanent facility. Landmark, which runs the East Street Cinema and the Bethesda Row Cinema, is opening two more theaters in D.C.
Oh, great.
There's going to be one along North Capitol Street, and there's going to be one near the 930 Club, just north of U Street Northwest.
Oh, great.
There is a chain, I can't remember the name of it, but a big multiplex mainstream theater chain that is opening a multiplex cinema near the Nationals ballpark in Southeast.
As part of the, you know, the whole
as part of that whole renovation. There are the really cool people at the National Community Church, which is known as the theater church or the popcorn church because it got its start renting space in movie theaters. They're opening a cinema on Barracks Row on Capitol Hill.
Oh, cool.
So, and then, you know.
And there's always the Avalon that's still there.
Right, the Avalon is very much still there. Mm-hmm. And then the Alamo Draft House, which has locations in Virginia, is looking at space in D.C. And then the Arclight Cinema and the IPIC Cinema, which opened luxury cinemas in what they call North Bethesda.
Montgomery Mall.
I mean, it's Rockville.
Right.
Just, it's Rockville.
Right.
But that aside, what they call North Bethesda, and you'd have to assume that at some point, assuming those cinemas do well, that they'll look for other locations in the city as well.
So there is a little, you're sensing a little optimism, even though we're sad about West End. There's still optimism for, you know, good quality movies to see at different places around town.
Right. As a film fan, I'm optimistic that in the course of the next couple of years, film fans are going to have lots of great choices.
Just backtracking a little bit. I want to know a little more about you personally. How did you become involved? I mean, are you from D.C.?
I am. Born and raised, fifth generation native Washingtonian. And the Washington I grew up in had 30 movie theaters, including some of the great art houses or independent houses and locally managed and owned chains. So,
did you have a favorite as a kid?
I loved going to the Key. I loved going to the Biograph. Mm-hmm. I loved going to the MacArthur. The Avalon was my neighborhood theater for a lot of my youth.
Mm-hmm. I guess the Uptown's been around a while, too.
And of course, obviously, you know, the iconic film moment of my youth was seeing Star Wars at the Uptown.
Wow. I think 2001 Space Odyssey also premiered at the Uptown, I believe.
It wouldn't surprise me. you know, I mean, that is just such a palace.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of great memories. And then there are a lot of little theaters that sort of time has forgotten along the way where I have fond memories as well. So part of the rationale for opening West End Cinema in 2010 was all those theaters had closed and the industry had consolidated into five locations in D.C.
The era of the movie palaces is long gone. And
well, the single screen movie palaces, definitely. It just makes no economic sense. So if you're at the Uptown and you book a film and it doesn't do well, you've got nothing else you can do for 6 weeks except for play to 1,000 empty seats.
Right.
That's suicide.
Right.
If you have 20 screens and a film doesn't do well, you have 19 other options.
Right. Okay.
So the economics just don't make sense for a single screen unless it's either a community supported nonprofit or B, it's part of a chain that can afford to lose money at that location, but use it as a prestige piece, as a premier venue. And for the two or three films a year that justify a huge 900-seat, 1,000-seat venue.
Right.
Is
that why a lot of these theaters, you know, AFI Silver gets renovated. I mean, a really historic theater, they renovate it, and now there's multiple screens in there. I mean, that's part of the model.
So they renovated the AFI Silver and preserved the main theater, and it's gorgeous.
Oh, it's one of my favorites in there. It's fantastic.
Yeah, they did such a great job. But it only made sense if they also built those other three theaters across the hallway, because when you're booking content, you can't afford to put all your eggs in one basket.
You don't know what's going to be a hit or a miss, you know?
Right. And
are they going to come to Nanochka tonight? We don't know. We might as well put this, this, and this there. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Yeah. And if you look at what they program, they do so much great repertory programming, but they'll have at least one first run film at all times as well.
Right.
And they're kind of hedging their bets.
So that's how you do the non eggs and all in one basket.
Right.
Okay.
You know, in the long run, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, right?
Right.
It would have probably meant more for our long-term survival at West End if we'd chosen a location with more than three screens. But, you know, we were a startup, and the capital costs of building your own cinema versus we found one intact.
Right.
You know, argued for taking that space, but
you had, you said you have three, I think it's there.
Three. There are three screens, yeah. Right. So we have 95 seats, 75 seats, and 48 seats, which if you add up combined, I think is still smaller than the smallest screen at the East, smallest room at the East Street.
I gotcha.
You know, so,
how many does East Street have? I know a bunch.
I want to say they have eight screens.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
Sounds about right.
I think that's correct. Six or eight, something like that. And, you know, of course, the mainstream houses, you're talking 14, 16, 18, 20 screens.
Right.
I think Georgetown has 14. I think Gallery Place has 20.
Right.
And that's sort of the range.
And for you guys with your three screens, were you, you opened in when, 2010?
Yeah, October of 2010.
Okay. Have you, you know, did you see attendance drop off steadily over the 5 years, or was it always kind of an uphill battle?
To
get people in there.
We saw our first year, we hit our projected attendance. The second year, we exceeded it. The last 2 years, we've had a drop off, definitely.
So why do you think that is? Is it just an explosion of streaming lately? Is it what would have changed in the last couple years?
Well, part of it is just the luck of the films that you get. Part of it is the industry had a bad 2013 and a worse 2014. So even though we're not showing the, you know, the cars that turn into robots movies and the superhero movies, the industry as a whole is, you know, we are a microcosm of the industry as a whole.
Right.
And if you look at the Academy Awards this year, the way that the awards were split among so many different films, only one of which, American Sniper, was a sort of mega hit.
Yeah. That was late in the game.
And that was very late in the game, and the industry didn't expect it to do nearly as well as it did.
Right.
There were a lot of surprised people, and congratulations to them. They made a really compelling film, and they did a great job releasing it. But there was no huge expectation within the industry that, oh, American Sniper is going to save our December.
Right.
Or our January. It just sort of, I mean, it's a Clint Eastwood film. It didn't come out of nowhere, but it exceeded everybody's expectations.
Yeah. Is this a larger decades-long picture here? I mean, I've noticed kind of a divide between, you know, let's say the 60s, for instance. The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, are great directed movies. They're artistic masterpieces that win Oscars. But kids would go watch The Graduate. Like, those were the mainstream blockbusters of their day. Same as through the 70s, a lot of the movies. But I'd say mid 80s, you know, Top Gun on, that kind of era, a lot of time when all the sequels and everything started coming out, you'll start noticing a divide between what are the year's top grossing movies and what gets nominated. Even think of like, you know, the musical eras in 50s and 40s, 50s, 60s. I mean, those were the top grossing movies, Sound of Music, all that stuff. But those also won the Oscars.
Sure.
So what's contributed to this dividing between what people pay to go see, which keep theaters like you alive, versus what's quality movies?
Well, I would say, even though I'm an art house operator, you know,
you got started with Star Wars, right?
Yeah, yeah. I always hold back from referring to art, you know, art as quality and mainstream stuff is not quality, because I love mainstream films too, and they are art. They are a different kind of art.
There's a place for it all.
Sure.
Along the film spectrum.
Well, indeed. And, you know, one of my most enjoyable film going experiences this past year was a film starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt called Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, it was a great flick.
Which was terrific, but had terrible marketing and a terrible title.
They even changed the title on the DVDs.
Yes.
Right? Live, Die, Repeat.
It, which they should have run with the first time, because Edge of Tomorrow sounds like a soap opera or a Douglas Sirk film from 1958.
Right, written on the wind or something.
Yeah, it's...
And instead... It's Groundhog Day for sci-fi action fans.
Exactly.
And that's what they should have done.
You know, I totally bought into the suspension of disbelief about this cycle, and I would watch Emily Blunt do anything, especially, you know, kill aliens. And Tom Cruise was...
Full Metal B-I-T-C-H was her name in the movie.
and Tom Cruise gave a really good performance. Mm-hmm. So I am by no means a effete snob who doesn't watch mainstream films.
Cinephile snob,
But to answer your question... There is an ongoing segmentation in all of entertainment. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that you had three channels in PBS.
Right.
Now you have 1,000 channels.
Those were the gateways, if you will.
Right. And so they did plenty of mainstream pap on the big three networks and PBS back in the day. But they also had stuff that we remember all these years later as great television.
Right.
And now you've got 1,000 channels. So... you know, a channel, a pipeline, if you will, because these are all pipelines between the creators and the audience.
Consumers, yeah.
The pipelines can be really narrow and just feed that niche, or they can try to be really broad. And usually the broader you go, the less specific you get.
Right.
And the same thing's true with movies. So if you're trying... to justify a film that has a $150 million budget, which are the numbers that the studios need to sort of feed the monster that
feed
they've
the beast.
Created, and to fill the venues that have been built to show these films, you can't go alt.
Sure.
You have to go
tried and true. Built-in brands.
Right.
You know.
So people are like, why are they always doing
characters.
These sequels or these reboots or taking a TV show and turning it into a movie?
Or a board game.
or a board game. Yeah.
Comics,
or a toy.
Yeah.
The answer is that there are hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of consumer education you don't need to do. You don't need to educate people what Batman, Batman. Who's Batman? Batman.
No. Batman. You are Batman.
Yeah. Please don't make me talk in that voice. you know, as opposed to even creating a new sci-fi or action or adventure character or storyline, you know, if you're going to make the Harry Potters, well, they've sold how many billions of books prior to you making it? And even that 50 Shades crap.
Yeah, right. It's the built-in.
Yeah, it's definitely built-in. And if I'm an investor... I wouldn't, but at least in theory, I would invest in 50 Shades of Grey before I invest in, you know, an Inuyasha film. Because as
the director of Birdman.
Right. And who was great on the Oscars.
Yeah.
And
great movie. I love the movie, but in terms of investing, exactly.
Right. I'd rather bet on Batman. It's a more likely audience out there. So
the odds are forever in your favor, Hunger Games. Style.
Exactly. And you know, whenever you see one of these big projects now, you have to look at the number of producers on the film and the number of writers on the film. The more writers equals the worse film.
Right, because it's gone through so many.
It ends up being, you know, something made by committee, which is always, not always,
often.
It is so often. A worse product.
Well, it becomes watered down. You get too many cooks in the kitchen.
Right, and there are too many notes that come back from the studio, and there are too many alterations that are made after you think you're done with the film, and you end up with something incoherent.
Yeah.
Whereas, to use Inuyasha for just one example, he had co-writers, but it was his vision.
His baby.
Not only did he write it, he directed it, he produced it. It had clear vision. Now, there are a lot of people who didn't like Birdman, and that's fine. You know, taste is taste, and entertainment's entertainment.
Movies
and
are subjective.
Right, you either enjoy something or you don't, and everybody's opinion is as valid as the next
person's.
But what you can say about Birdman is that it didn't have a specific point of view and a specific thought that runs through line, Right, a true vision. Boyhood's another example, and that was an amazing concept, but... People who went to see the film after they read all the industry insider and reviews talking about how amazing
all the
it was
hype,
were let down. And we had it at West End Cinema, and you could see it in people. people's reactions. When you tell somebody, you're going to see something that you've never seen before. Right. They're expecting, you know, Avatar or
right.
The Matrix.
Right.
Like, I've literally never seen
right.
that before. Right. Whereas...
Now, here's an interesting concept that right. you haven't seen.
Yeah. Right. What was amazing about Boyhood is how it was conceived and brought to fruition. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really good film, but it's an intimate family
slice film. Of life film. It's not a traditional storytelling structure. There's no catalyst on page 10 and a journey for the hero and
right.
a villain and all
and,
that.
And the product that was delivered very well, but the product itself, the finished film itself, was something you have seen before in the sense that a boy grows up.
Right.
There have been other films about that.
Right.
Not as well done, in my opinion. But sure. So, you know, it was a victim, I think, a little bit of the hype and expectation.
You think that's why it tailed off throughout award season, too? It's like politics. No one likes the clear front runner. It's the Hillary Clinton syndrome.
It makes no sense how these things are decided.
Right.
And I don't know if it tailed off or just that the awards it was going to win came earlier in the season.
Yeah, maybe.
Possibly. Who knows? What's really missing from the picture is what I would refer to as the middle class.
Right.
Of films, right? The studios can only justify their model mm-hmm. with huge
tentpoles, yeah.
action adventure, broad comedy,
yeah.
big stars, well-known brands.
Right.
And then for the more adventurous or artistic-minded films, they have to be low budget because there's just not a lot of money out there. Mm-hmm. And what's missing is sort of the intelligent adult romantic comedy that's right. like the $40 to $60 million film. So it's not the $150 million film right. and it's not the $10 million film.
Yeah, exactly.
It is that sort of, and by middle class, I don't in any way mean it's not intelligent or it's not.
Right, just
financially. It's not well done.
Middle, yeah.
But financially, it's sort of mid-level that speaks not to the 17-year-old kids. And not to this tiny sort of
niche. Yeah, cinephile.
Right. You know, I'm not the world's biggest romantic comedy fan, but romantic comedy is a hugely important genre. Right.
And when done well, it can be awesome.
Right.
It's just one of those it sometimes
And it's really hard to think of many romantic comedies of the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And especially ones that were well done.
Right. You think of when Harry Met Sally's been like 25 years ago.
Yeah. Or, you know...
I think it was guys, Crazy Stupid Love. Does that count?
Was that a romantic comedy there? Or was that like
more of a family thing? Yeah, I don't know what it would be. Does 500 Days of Summer count? That's dark, too. It's not really... So, I don't know. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some examples. You're right. They prove your point.
Yeah, so... and I'm like, I don't watch horror, but horror is an incredibly important... You came to see Babadook.
I saw the Babadook.
Right, I didn't.
Well, it's an Australian horror movie.
We showed it, but you know, I was in the lobby with my hands over my ears. You know, those are generally inexpensive, generally speaking, inexpensive to make, and you sort of throw them out there. Mm-hmm. They don't get 2,000 screen releases generally.
Right.
So you've got a lot of narrow casting going on with the genres, and not a lot of like solid middle budget. Studio-backed films.
Right. You're either a huge tentpole that the studio's behind, or you're an indie movie that another independent company's behind that's really low budget, but the middle ground we're losing, you're saying.
Yeah. And then there's also just things run in waves. That's true in life. It's true in film. You know, a lot of the auteurs of, say, the last 20 years are now crowdfunding their films because...
Right.
They don't fit that construct, mm-hmm. or they've stopped making films and switched to television or other media. You know, if you're somebody who watched a lot of film in the 80s and 90s, Spike Lee is not on the radar anymore.
Right.
So he crowdfunded his last film. We played it for a week. Nobody came.
And he was the hot, in late 80s, early 90s, he was the hottest thing since sliced bread.
Not only was he a hot director, he was an absolute cultural phenomenon.
Absolutely.
As was Michael Moore, who doesn't make film, or at least hasn't for several years, and has announced that he's not making film and interacts with the world in other ways. You know, and Kevin Smith.
Oh, yeah. Clerks, yeah.
Right. isn't getting studio backing.
Right.
You know, I don't know that Harvey Weinstein's returning his calls. Jon Favreau, who sort of exploded yeah. as an indie filmmaker with Swingers, you know, didn't make another indie film for 20 years.
He did Chef, right?
Right. And that was
off the Iron Man movies he had right. to do in between. Yeah.
Right. It helps when you can have Robert Downey Jr. and Scarlett Johansson yeah. and Sofia Vergara
yeah.
Drop in.
Yeah, exactly.
And help make your film.
Right.
You know,
Dustin Hoffman too.
Right. Yeah, yeah. For scale. But, you know, he went the other way and then came back to it. And I love Chef. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it was a personal film from him after 15 years of mainstream.
Sure.
After his career was launched by a personal film. Mm-hmm. And it was a luxury.
Right.
In essence.
Right.
So part of what's different is I don't think that the studios have the same long-term relationships with their talent. I mean, I'm not talking going back to the days of the studio system, but even in the 70s and 80s,
right.
You know, there, you know, all of Stallone's films for mm-hmm. a while came from the same studio. Right. And
Erwin Winkler and right, Robert Chartoff.
Right. And if he wanted to do something that was not Rambo, right, or Rocky, they had a reasonable expectation that even if it didn't perform that well, that his next Rocky or Rambo right. would.
He's our guy, so we're going to ride him out.
Right. Yeah. And you know, that's how things used to get greenlit. But even to Tom Cruise these days, I mean, who is his studio
right,
that's
right.
going to back a more, edgy is not the right word, but a more non-mainstream
right.
sort of sure. pap film, you know, in exchange for doing the next big
yeah.
Tom Cruise film. I just don't think that the same sort of career models exist, which means that people have to, you know, they're basically on one film contracts mm-hmm. and you can't afford to miss.
Yeah, exactly. Bringing it back to, you know, what you have been doing at the West End, do you see it ever coming back? Are you personally going to try a theater elsewhere, or are you probably, it was like, well, it was nice for me, but I'm on to something else.
Well, I definitely love doing what I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just faced with the unfortunate reality that I can't keep doing it where I'm doing it.
Right.
And as we were discussing before, you look at Washington and over the next couple of years, there's going to be so many new venues. I don't know that it makes sense to do in DC. Would I do it right. somewhere else? Possibly. Again, it's been a labor of love since the day we opened, but there's a reason they call it a labor of love. I love doing it. But it has to make economic sense. Sure. And so I don't know where that next location would be. As for the future of exhibition more broadly, mm-hmm. You know, there's always speculation that internet or mobile or the chips that they're going to implant in our brains.
have yours yet?
No.
I got mine installed yesterday.
I'm on the waiting list.
Oh, okay. Maybe after the end of
bad
March.
Bad insurance. Yeah. You know? The history of film is blank is going to kill the film business.
Right.
Television was going to kill the film industry. It didn't.
Right.
The film industry ended up finding a new profit center in sure. television.
Yeah.
VHS, the right. introduction of home video
model, yeah.
was going to kill the film business. It didn't. It created a new profit center for the film business. Yeah. Cable, the explosion of cable.
Home right? box office.
Home
this
box
is going to ruin the regular box office.
Right.
Yeah.
It didn't. It right. just gave film a new profit center, the DVD, and then now the internet. Now, the internet is, it's tough.
Is this our trickiest beast yet?
It is, because it can run on user-generated content.
Mm-hmm.
So where are the most videos consumed on the internet?
Right.
And, you know, you look at Netflix, which tends to be professionally mm-hmm. produced.
Right.
Right. And then you look at YouTube,
mm-hmm.
which tends to be...
That's where most people watch.
right. Tends to be stuff that people shoot of their idiot cousin falling off right. the roof of their house
landing
in the backyard.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the way that cable television, you know, it doesn't have user-generated right. content, although reality TV certainly looks like it, but that's a different conversation for a different day.
We'll have you in again to talk that.
Yeah.
After you get your chip installed.
Yeah, after I get my chip installed. but... I am 100% committed to the future of exhibition
mm-hmm.
of film. For one thing, it is how we view the highest form of visual art.
Yeah.
That is the model that we look at yeah. for the last century plus. And I believe very strongly that there is now, and there will continue to be in the future, a robust market for that experience where you leave your home.
Yeah, sit in a dark room with a group of people.
With a group of people, and you see something on a screen that is larger than your cell phone, that is larger than your TV even in the living room. Mm-hmm. It is larger than life. And
a shared experience.
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, it's really hard to make out with somebody looking, you know, looking at your cell phone,
right?
Watching a
the
YouTube
screen's
video.
Gonna move, yeah.
For one thing, you got to move really quickly because most YouTube videos are pretty short,
right?
You know, and it's hard to do the yawn move.
Oh,
right?
You mean the reach around
yeah.
arm?
Yeah,
yawn.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
you might knock the earpiece out of her.
That's true.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So there's gonna be a reason for the movies to continue to exist.
Sure.
Also, there's an economic issue. People will complain about how much a bucket of popcorn costs, and I understand that. But if you look at out-of-the-home entertainment experiences, film is going to the movies is still really inexpensive compared to going to a ball game,
right.
compared to going to live theater, concert. Compared to going to a music concert. I mean, the ticket prices for the Wizards or for the Kennedy Center or for you know, something at 9:30 Club, they are much higher than the cost of going to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think film can continue to compete as a affordable entertainment option as well.
So what do you have on tap for the West End for the final few weeks? Are there any special screenings or what's going to be playing there as you head out the door?
Well, we have the kind of programming that we've done really well with. We have a really cool documentary opening next Friday called The Mind of Mark DeVriest. It's made by a local filmmaker, Gabriel London.
Cool.
About the guy in Florida who's known as the Houdini of the Florida penal system. He's escaped, I can't remember how many times. He was originally charged with and convicted of a theft that got him 4 years in jail. He's been in jail now for 30 years because every time he escapes, they essentially double his sentence. and the film is incredibly well told. It uses the animation to recreate the escapes.
What's it called?
It's called The Mind of Mark DeVriest. And on the one hand, it's a sort of a caper film.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it discusses the sort of politics or the ethics or morality of our prison system. But it's also really entertaining. It is really well made. So, you know, that's the kind of film we exist to show, and I'm glad that we'll be showing this film. And then the next week, the 20th, the last film that I have booked as a regular film is the anniversary restored Grey Gardens, the Maisels Brothers, all-time great documentary about these relatives of Jackie Onassis, who were just I can't say bat bleep. I can't say bat bleep. I can't
say
the
bat bleep.
Yeah, bat bleep crazy. And is just, you know, a benchmark in documentary film. Sure. So we have that coming up.
Is that
up.
The final pick? Is there a certain personal pick that you're going to walk out on?
I think we might do some things that last weekend.
Right.
That might be my personal picks. But, you know,
still developing.
Since we opened, you know, this was never the Josh Levin theater. It's never been about what I like. It's always been about what we think there we can find an audience for. That last weekend might be Josh Levin theater. we might, you know, I might do some of my favorite things.
Sure.
But as always, you know, all we really wanted to do from the day we opened was create a space where people could come and enjoy themselves. That's it. You know, and so it's always been about finding films that there are audiences out there and then bringing those audiences to those films and then also hopefully exposing new people to new ways of telling stories.
Now, looking back over the whole journey of the last 5 years,
yeah,
what movie, if you had to pick one or two, what did the best for you? How many, you know, what brought the most butts in the seats?
There are sort of two buckets of films to that answer. The first is... every holiday slash award season, starting with The Social Network in 2010/11, we have had films that were studio films and prestige films at the same time. So they would play at Georgetown at the Multiplex or at Regal Gallery Place Multiplex and at the Art Houses. And just to rattle off a few of them that we've had that have also been at the big houses, Social Network, Django Unchained, Silver Linings Playbook, The Wolf of Wall Street. You know, those films have done really well for us while they've also had this larger life at the mainstream theaters. Argo was a fascinating case study because the distributors of the film, although they were very high on the film, weren't sure if it was going to work as a mainstream film. So they hedged their bets, and we opened the same day as
that
it
helped
opened.
You guys out.
Yeah, it helped us a great deal. And it did gangbusters for us, and it did gangbusters, and then it went on to awards glory. It worked on every level. But it was just interesting internally because, you know, sort of within the film industry, they knew they had a really, really good film. They just didn't know where it would live. And so we were the beneficiary of their uncertainty.
Were there any on the flip side that were surprises in the opposite direction that you thought would be a sure bet that flopped?
You know, the truth is there are too many films to mention. Because we wouldn't book a film if we didn't think we could find an audience or there wasn't an audience. And then sometimes you look around on Saturday and you're like, where the hell is everybody? You know, why is the theater empty? And it's for whatever reason. It just didn't connect or didn't have the marketing muscle to connect. But, you know, the second bucket of films that I was mentioning, the ones that are sort of dearest to my heart are the documentaries that we found huge audiences for. I'm a fan of and a producer of documentary films. I love that genre, that way of storytelling, that that world. And we've had films that, you know, haven't done very well nationally or haven't done very well in other markets, but we've had great success with. So National Geographic did a crowdsourced film called Life in a Day, where they had people from all over the world film what happened on that day. And National Geographic flopped with the film. It didn't play well anywhere, but we played it for, I think we had it 7 or 8 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And they kept asking us, what are we doing? You know,
what are you doing that we're not?
What magic were we sprinkling in the water to get people to come out in droves? And the answer is nothing. I mean, it just worked. It worked because we had
Can't
the audience
predict it
for
sometime.
It. We had a film called The House I Live In by Eugene Jarecki about the failure of the war on drugs. It was a huge hit for us. We've been playing Citizen 4 so long, we actually dropped it and had to pick it up again back to, due to customer demand. And of course, then it won the Oscars.
This is the Edward Snowden documentary.
Right, by Laura Poitras. We had a film called The Square, which was bought by or acquired by Netflix. And they didn't want to do theatrical because they're Netflix. They wanted to put it on Netflix. And the filmmakers insisted, you have to give us at least a chance to do a theatrical. And so we got the film, and that film had an entire team of people reaching out to groups, right? It's a film about Tahrir Square in Egypt and the Arab Spring, and it was very well made. But it was incredibly well marketed. The filmmaker, the team that she worked with to drive traffic to the theaters, we had group after group after group buy out shows. And we just kept running it for weeks. It was kind of a phenomenon for us. And then we had a film that we opened West End Cinema with called Boudris, which was produced by a local group called Just Vision. And, you know, 4 weeks into that run, they were still coming out and doing Q&As and bringing groups. You know, it was the kind of
music to your ears.
Well, it's the kind of ground game that documentaries especially, but small budget, non-studio backed films have to make. It's it's really almost a second full-time job after making the film is releasing the film. And they did the work and they were great to work with. And it was a great film. So those are the ones I remember maybe more than
Right.
The absolute top dollar grossers were the great documentary surprises that we had.
Right. You can get a sense of accomplishment out of those. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Look what happened. Right. We weren't expecting this.
Yeah. Right. Because, you know, Social Network was magic for us. It was great.
Right.
And, you know, it helped subsidize, frankly, a lot of the misses during that first
West
year.
End was the house that Social Network built.
Yeah. You know, but the fact is that the Social Network would have been just fine without us. But, you know, for these documentary films and some of the foreign films that we've had success with and some of the festival and series that we've run, you know, they really don't have.
It's a little more of a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
They help them as much as they help
They literally
you.
Didn't have a screen in Washington. And, you know, those were the relationships in the films that I treasure the most.
Well, hopefully you can hold on to those memories that you treasure for a while, and we're going to be, we're sad to see it go, but get out to the West End Cinema over the next couple of weeks. It's your last chance to do it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the lights are on until Sunday the 29th, so come on out and enjoy a show, and enjoy the best popcorn in D.C. We were named Best Popcorn, and that title remains until the 29th of March. Then
Salesman
I have to give
to
it
to
up.
The very end.
Hell yeah. And we have a full bar, so come out and have a drink, too.
There you go. There's the pitch. Thanks so much for coming on WTOP.
Thanks for having me.